Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets meander with a slight uptick for the week. China relations continue to erode. And wondering, what's up with stock splits? And we have another great guest this week, Danielle DiMartino Booth from Quill Intelligence. All this and much more on episode number 675 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the swelter, at least here in South Florida. It is brutal out. That's where our offices are and our studios. And man, I don't even want to go outside. It's kind of my eyeballs get foggy once I walk outside with that humidity. But it is the summer. It's going to start cooling off, I guess, soon enough. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And thanks for joining me this week and every week where we bring you some really solid educational, informational, and maybe even some ways to make some profits along the way. That's what we're trying to do here, of course. You can find me also on DH Unplugged. That's where I co-host with John C. Dvorak on Tuesday evenings. And we talk about kind of the lighter side of finance. And we have some games that we play with our audience and the listeners. It's a lot of fun. I got to tell you something. That is a great podcast. And so you can check that out. We do it live on Tuesdays. And you can also get it on any podcast directory or anywhere you want to look for it. So kind of want to let you know, because if you've been with me a while, you know, I just love the idea of cooking, right? And lately I've been doing a lot of barbecue and I've been doing a lot of smoke. So this weekend is going to be a full test of the new smoker, that Traeger I got. We're going to do a 12-pound brisket on there. I'm going to let you know how it goes. I'm undecided of whether or not I want to just do it with the Traeger alone, with all of its settings and the wood that I have for it, or if I want to add an additional smoke tube to get some excessive smoke in there, because, I don't know, I'm kind of torn. On one hand, I want to just check out what the Traeger can do. On the other hand, I really want smoke in this brisket, so I don't know what's going to happen here. It's going to be about a 12 or a 14-hour total smoke process, and I got some new rubs. I got a few new toys for the smoker. It's got this cool shelf that's magnetic and a really cool magnetic cutting board, wooden, that goes on there, and some other tongs and some stuff that I got. I kind of decided I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to be home, if I'm going to be doing this already, maybe I'll refresh some of the things that I have. So I will let you know. Watch on Twitter. I'll make sure to put some pictures over the weekend of what this process looks like, etc. I also want to mention that next week, we have another great guest, Pierce Crosby. He's with TradingView. And this is a really cool charting and trading platform. If you haven't gone to TradingView before next week, I really encourage you to do so, because you can see all the things that you can do either on the web app or the mobile application. Either one of those, I use that to track a variety of cryptocurrencies on my phone, as well as futures and stocks. Just kind of one of the few different ones that I use to keep abreast of what's happening with various parts of the market. And speaking of markets, what's going on? Well, this week we had a decent bid, I would call it, for the post-pandemic trade sectors. We saw that growth was bested again by value, which you don't really see that often these days, where banks are doing better and some of the non-growthy style positioning does better, because it's all been about technology and biotech for the last several months. And every once in a while, like we saw last week, all of a sudden, everybody decides that, you know what? It's time for a rotation. It's time to get into the things that weren't working, because maybe it's going to start working in the future. And it seems there's some confusion about what's going on in the country in terms of the path of the virus. Even though we said just this week, we saw record deaths in Florida and lower testing, but higher positivity. The whole thing has gotten very mushy in terms of the reporting. And I think that's part of it. In fact, we really even haven't seen, as we had seen before, the daily case counts come across my news tickers like we were seeing for a while. So I think the impact of the virus, maybe because unfortunately we're used to it and it's something we're dealing with, and of the potential closings and openings and lockdowns in New Zealand and other areas around the world and new case outbreaks in China, it's not really consuming anything to do with the markets, because I think that, which we'll talk about with our guest, hopefully, that the Fed has, and central banks around the world, have basically done such a job and such a number on our psyche with the idea that they can just solve all problems and provide for an incredible amount of replacement for any of the economic damage and losses. They're kind of like the Geico, I guess, of the financial system, right? You got a problem, they pay off. But it seems that right now that has really, for whatever reason, been put on the back burner. Maybe, as I am, as you are, we're all kind of disgusted, tired, and fed up with this whole virus shenanigans. You know, I mean, it's serious. Of course it's serious. But we also have to live our lives. I'm not going to go into a whole diatribe and a discussion about this, but I'm just saying this because I think it's possible that markets are ignoring, or at least putting it to the side and looking for other things beyond. And that's why you may be seeing some of the post-pandemic trades and what's happening in the markets right now pick up in a way that is going to favor them moving forward. We'll have to keep a watch. That doesn't mean it's necessarily going to hurt the other areas, although those are, we've seen some of the go-go growth get absolutely obliterated over the last couple of weeks when the earnings come out and everybody's like, oh, they only have, you know, 8% growth. We were expecting 50. And the stock's down 20, 30%. Rightfully so, because they were bid up so far with the idea that they were going to take over the world tomorrow. Now, one of the other things we saw that really stuck out during the week, it really made an impression, was what happened midweek and throughout the week with gold and silver and some of the metals. Now, mind you, the metals have been a great trade of late, right? You can't deny the fact that gold and silver have been a really good positioning in a portfolio. And even though they got sold off with the rest of the markets, they really came back very strong and they really started making a big move over the last couple of months. In fact, silver, I would say over the last 3 weeks, went parabolic. Everybody's like, now I want silver. Gotta have silver, you know? And while it may be a good place to be, and we've talked about this time and time again, about silver being a metal, but also has industrial uses, a little less than it used to have, but still it has a little bit more utility than simply gold as a precious metal. When you looked at the way that it rose, and it rose for several days in a row, 6%, that 15% sell-off in one day, which was relatively historic in the recent past, I don't think it was unexpected. It was bound to happen. I mean, nothing goes up forever, right? Aside from Apple, okay? But when we look at what's happened in the world and the reason why people are moving towards things like precious metals and maybe even Bitcoin as an example, and what's going on with Ethereum, I think it's a sign of a few ways of people thinking about this and what's happening. Some people are looking at the unrest around the world and saying, you know, where can I put money that I don't feel as worried about, that is an alternative to a quote unquote financial asset that is your standard run-of-the-mill stock, bond, cash, real estate, etc. So they're saying, you know, with all the things that we're seeing and the concern about, you know, what's happening in Belarus, what's happening in Hong Kong, what's happening with relations around the world, maybe it's one thing. Then there's also people thinking, you know what, hey, there's a debasement of currencies that's happening on a consistent basis with central banks, and Mexico just dropped theirs again, and the U.S. continuing to drop their interest rates as low as possible, buying bonds, all the things that are going on with central banks around the world. And in effect, what they're doing is debasing the currencies across the board. Now, we don't see it as much as you would think you would see it, because what's happening is everybody's doing it together. So the tub is being drained and everything is going down together. So therefore, everything is kind of on a even keel from that perspective. When you look from a different perspective, when you don't do a cross-currency review and you look at really what's gone on and every currency really dropping, and that's why we've gone from millions to billions to trillions. I used to laugh. I used to think, you know, when we talk about a trillion yen surplus in Japan, I'm like, oh, God, those guys really did a number on their currency, didn't they? When they have to start doing this in a developed country, which has to start quoting it in trillions of yen. Well, that's what happened here now. Just 10 years ago, 12 years ago, bailouts were in the $750 billion range, which was extraordinary for its time. Fast forward 10 years, the bailout is $7 trillion and counting in the U.S. That has an impact on the value of the currency. And therefore, people that are looking at that as this debasement kind of trade are looking to buy precious metals as well. And then you have the other thing, which is hard to really pin down right now because it's really not necessarily showing up. It's not there, but it kind of is. And that's inflation. And the idea that inflation could be picking up with all the excess stimulus and liquidity in the markets, if in fact we have more that comes in from here, and if this whole thing cures itself. Remember, it was supposed to be temporary. Wasn't this all supposed to be over on Easter? That's what we were told. Yep. By Easter, churches will be open. We're back in business. Now, I don't know. Maybe they didn't talk about Easter 2020. They meant Easter 2021, possibly. But not probable, right? I mean, come on. A lot of wishful thinking. Here we are in August. We're talking about 8 months. Let's see. It started February, 6 months. A good 6 months. About 3 months past when anybody expected this to really last. But yet we still have a significant amount of money coming into the markets from central banks. We have the potential for prices to go up because excess money is being given through fiscal stimulus. And that is perking the antennas up of those in the inflation camp saying, well, maybe I need to buy some gold and silver. So you have three different distinct camps that are thinking about alternatives to traditional assets. And therefore, what they're doing is they're going into gold and silver. And then the stampede happens with the Momo crowd after everybody starts really picking this all up. But what's interesting to note is that inflation, even though we saw this week the CPI at a 0.5%, which annualizes out at 6%, 0.5% month over month is 6% annualized. But on a year-over-year basis, it's still well below. It's like 1.2. It's still well below trend, and it's well below the point at which the Fed says, you know, hey, we're going to look at this as a 2% level and maybe a little bit more. And also realize something, that a lot of that was due to a 5% increase in energy costs, or basically gasoline. As we got back on the road, gas prices came up, oil prices came up. So a lot of what we saw in CPI and in PPI was energy related for the last month. So I don't think that inflation is really here yet. However, it sure feels like it is. And it looks like there's like, if you kind of sit back and think about it, it looks like the table is set for us to have inflationary pressures in the future. So that's what's going on with gold. And depending on your portfolio, you know, it depends on if you want to invest in it. Now, I'll tell you, we're continue to be bullish on commodities and metal. We've been wrong for a while, finally getting right about this. We have a position across our portfolio strategies for our clients that are in that. As a matter of fact, we talked about this. It was this Monday where we had our Horowitz & Company pop-up Q&A webinars, which you can register for. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's on the right side. And in that discussion, someone asked me the question, how much is the appropriate amount of gold and silver to have in my portfolio? Now, that's an open-ended question. But for example, like 5% of your portfolio in commodities does help with diversification. Depends on your risk, depends on your outlook, of course. But I think that's kind of important to think about adding these alternative asset classes that don't necessarily correlate or work with hand in hand the direction of markets of traditional assets. It kind of makes sense from a diversification standpoint. So I want you to think about that. And finally, I want to just mention something. I want to mention getting back to that Apple discussion we had earlier. So Apple started it. Tesla followed along. What I'm talking about is splits, stock splits. For a long time, essentially stock splits were absent from the markets. I mean, I remember thinking not too long ago, hey, what happened? What's going on? You know, these companies that have big prices these days, they're not splitting. They usually split. They used to split. But now we have partial shares and fractional shares that you can buy from some of the major players, or even ETFs that are available that have big proportions of these stocks in it if you want to buy it, so you get a nice piece of it if you invest there. Seems that stock splits were kind of a thing of the past until all of a sudden Apple decided to do a 4-for-1 and Tesla comes in with a 5-for-1. And what happened? This is the interesting part. We saw Apple stock on that announcement just take off. Tesla ramped higher. No question about that. And it hasn't stopped. And the reason why it's happening, it's kind of weird. Because if you think about a stock split, it doesn't do anything for the stock, for the fundamentals. So what's the benefit? Well, the benefit is that it makes it appear cheaper. Kind of a bit of a ruse. Makes it appear cheaper. So people can buy shares that maybe weren't in it. And what's happening is now they're running ahead of that trade thinking, well, if Apple gets down from 400 or so down to 100, there's going to be a lot more people trying to buy shares of Apple. So therefore, why don't we get ahead of that trade? It makes no sense. It makes no sense. There's no difference between a pound of, you know, what weighs more, a pound of steel or a pound of feathers? What's better, to have four quarters or a dollar? It's all the same. So we're going to keep watching this because it's possible that a lot more companies may be looking to do this in the future. And in particular, we got to look at those names that are pretty pricey. So you look at companies like Booking Holdings. You look at companies like maybe Google, maybe Amazon. And these companies could be ripe for this if they're seeing that, hey, you know what? If we split our stock, it goes up like 12% in a couple of days. I think I like that. So it's possible that in a time when companies have a lot of uncertainty and they want to give back to the shareholders in the form of a higher price, if it's being done in a way when we have a manic market that are bidding up companies that are bankrupt, well, let's take advantage of it. There's nothing wrong with the companies doing that, but I want you to realize that there's no benefit to the bottom line, to the earnings, the fundamentals, or anything like that at all. At all. Finally, before we get to our guests, I want to mention something that we're kind of working on right now. One of the things that's really interesting is that we've been doing our stock screens for fundamentals for a while. And once again, this is the second time in about a year, all of a sudden, we're seeing a big drop off in the number of names that are coming through our screen. The quality of earnings, of revenue growth, of margin increases, of internals, and the fundamentals of companies have been slowing, and that's a problem. So when we look at that for the disciplined investor managed growth strategy, that long short strategy we have, it's kind of interesting to notice that we're probably going to end up dropping some of the allocation towards core equities in our next rotation that's coming up. So it's something to really think about, because one of the ways that we protect portfolios in an environment where fundamentals are starting to wane is by reducing exposure. So just something to think about. If you want to check it out, go over to the Disciplined Investor. That strategy is there too. You definitely check that out. Love to have you as a client, especially if you're looking for an alternative to some of the things that are going on in the markets right now. All right, with that, I want to get to our guest because I'm pretty excited. We've had Danielle DiMartino Booth on before. and she's always given us some great insight. And I thought that, you know, with all that's going on right now and with what's happening with central banks around the world, it's really high time that we get her back on. So let's get her and bring her right in. And our guest today is Danielle DiMartino Booth, who is the CEO and chief strategist of Quill Intelligence, which is a research and analytics firm. And she's also the author of Fed Up, an insider's take on why the Federal Reserve is bad for America. And prior to Quill, she spent some time, just 9 years, at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, where she served as an advisor to Richard Fisher. And she knows the inside and out about what's going on inside the Fed. So, Danielle, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. You holding up through all this?
Yeah, reasonably well enough. You know, I miss my old way of life. I was never somebody to go to a restaurant and look for a reserve table. I always tried to muscle my way in at the bar and eat at the bar with my husband. And that's not happening again anytime soon. So, but other than that, you know, it's life's okay here.
Yeah, I hear you. So I have a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about. And I thought the first thing I have to ask you is about the Fed, because the Fed has been such an integral part. You know, years and years ago, the Fed was kind of like, okay, that there's a body of people that do something. And now they're front and center. They've been front and center for the last decade, obviously, since, what, Bernanke and Yellen. But if we can kind of go through, what do you think the thinking inside the Fed is right now? Now that they have help from the fiscal side, where they're getting stimulus from the government, and, you know, what's going on there?
You know, I don't know that the Fed necessarily thinks that it's getting the stimulus that it really needs on the fiscal side. You know, if I'm Jay Powell, I'm still sleeping with one eye open. I mean, you know, there's been some movement in LQD, if you will, in the biggest investment grade bond portfolio. There's been a little bit of movement in bond market volatility these last few days, despite the Fed being as knee deep in these markets as it is. So, I actually think the Fed wants more from fiscal authorities.
Well, I mean, maybe that's probably due to the fact that Congress can't get their act together, which is, you know, nothing new. But I thought we'd do this. We would take a moment and just kind of sit ourselves as flies on the wall inside of a Fed meeting. You know, let's kind of talk about the call to order comes in. Jay Powell is presiding. And what are the first things they're looking at?
Well, look, it's still yesterday's and yesteryear's Fed. So they're still going to look at, unfortunately, a lot of seasonally adjusted long-term type of data trends, which have approximately nothing to do with where the economy is right now. But hopefully there are some younger analysts in the building who are kind of forcing into the forefront some of the more real-time data sources that we here over in the real world have come to rely on a day-to-day basis. And then, you know, they presumably ignore the financial markets and the bubbles that they're blowing and pat themselves on the back for maintaining financial stability.
So I kind of have this vision of cigars lighting, whiskey glasses clinking as they meet, as they see asset prices going higher. Am I so off on that?
They definitely, I mean, you know, look, Bernanke was the one who said that Bill Dudley also, you know, it's a sign of a robust economy if you've got a stock market that's up there. I hope that that's not going on, but I suspect that it still is. The Fed is not a place where a crisis is going to bring about change. So the scariest part is that depending on who you ask and on what day it is, this new generation of retail traders, the Robin Hooders, if you will, they're estimated to be between 20 to 25% of volume. And that means that the Fed is kind of, you know, playing with millennials' money when millennials don't have any money to play with.
Yeah, and maybe even the fiscal money that came out for the $600 per week. You know, the other thing about the Fed that I think people need to know is they're just people, right? They're not gods. You wrote a piece called, what was called, The Spartans of Central Banking. But we're going to get to that in a second. They have portfolios. They are not fully objective or, you know, detached from this. Jay Powell has an enormous portfolio. Now, he may not own individual stocks. He may not own individual bonds. but he has ETFs. He has mutual funds. That's got to play into this, doesn't it?
Well,
I mean, they're people.
You know, they are people. They are people. But most of the people at the Fed are not wealthy like Jay Powell. And a lot of the people at the Fed actually are there because of these enormous benefits that, I mean, look, I was there for 9 years. I have a pension that I can start collecting when I'm 72 years old. I was only there for 9 years, but a full-blown defined benefit plan. There was a 401k plan and a very nice fat matching. My health care was like the Cadillac health care plan. I think a lot of people at the Fed are there for the benefits for life type of thing, more bureaucrats in nature, as opposed to Jay Powell, who he's not a PhD in economics, which is kind of unusual for a Fed chair. And he did have a net worth of somewhere between $50 and $100 million coming into the Fed, meaning he was not taking the position to increase his wealth, but rather I think he took the position initially because he felt that it was the right thing to do to serve his country. It was only after he discovered that the bond market was a lot bigger than he was that he really had to break down, do the Powell pivot. Since then, however, you know, I think he's possibly also suffered a concussion.
Yeah, well, and you know, because, you know, let's just say he's worth $50 million. You take a 30% hit on that, that's a $15 million whack. That maybe, you know, you're thinking, maybe I'll do a little something to bring that back a little bit. But nonetheless, do you think as they're sitting there, they're talking, and whether or not they have their cigars lit or not, are they discussing and thinking about the balance sheet, which is just extraordinary?
If anything at all, you're talking about lip service, and I'm being generous because their feeble attempt at normalizing the size of the balance sheet was an utter failure. So if they think that they can extricate themselves, then they're absolutely delusional, and they're drinking something a lot stronger than what you and I are talking about here.
I mean, how are they going to get out of this? The truth is that the first problem is that even if they hint about getting out of it, the traders and algos know just to blow a tantrum just to get their attention. And then you got the potential bond vigilantes, which at this point aren't even, I don't even think they're a big deal because the size of what we're dealing with, the scope of what we have on there. And then also the amount of debt that's outstanding. They raised the rates on debt, the debt service on it for any renewables that come through the process for either the Fed or for the government. It's a whole different calculation, right?
It is. It is. I don't know. I think a lot of the things when it comes to the Fed are different calculations. And I think that that's, if you want to step back to where we first started this out, that's one of the things that I think the average person needs to understand about the Federal Reserve is that you have people like Mary Daly, who runs the San Francisco Fed, coming out over the wires yesterday and saying that, voicing her concerns that Fed policy, excuse me, voicing her concerns that COVID was going to increase the inequality divide.
Yeah.
I mean, these people live on a different damn planet.
Yeah, that's not necessarily. Well, how are they going to do that? Because, I mean, really, they are part of the problem. Let's talk about that. They're part
of the problem.
They're part of the wealth gap. I mean, during this whole process, you have how many tens of millions of people that are unemployed. I don't understand how lowering interest rates helps them. I don't understand how lowering capital gains tax, not their bailiwick, but helps people to get employed. I don't understand how buying bonds, which is a shift from left pocket, right pocket, adding liquidity to the markets, helps anybody get a job. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just stupid about this.
Well, no, but because you're using the operative verb, right? Get a job. Even a payroll tax cut doesn't help somebody who does not have a job.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you have to say to yourself, who are these people exactly trying to help? Because it sure as hell is not. I mean, look, as I said in another recent interview, I'm like, first and last time I've ever agreed with anything that's come out of Elizabeth Warren's mouth. But in a congressional hearing recently with Powell, a virtual hearing, she asked him the question. She's like, you know, for all of its warts, at least the payroll protection program has strictures that require that you retain employment. Nothing in any of the Fed's programs requires that employees be retained. Not even the Main Street Lending Program requires that employees be retained. And I don't think anybody has really examined this closely enough, because the Fed has in this post-pandemic era, the Fed has all but abandoned its second mandate of maximizing employment.
Right. And the first one, which is price stability, which can be looked at in a couple different ways. The old way we used to look at that was inflation, right? The whole idea that inflation was kept into check. Then they come up with this semi-arbitrary 2% number in the latest gyration of all this, which seems to be adopted, by the way, by the rest of the world as well, which may or may not be consistent with their particular economies. But they have this 2% inflation rate. That was the old one, right? The old one was like, you know, make sure there's not too much inflation, definitely make sure there's not deflation. Now, the whole idea of price stability, I've kind of expanded out to, well, you know, if you think about it, I think that means stock markets and bond markets and asset prices.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And it should not, because the Fed is only supposed to be active in its role of ensuring financial stability when markets are unstable, not when markets are at all-time highs. So no, this is beyond the realm of ridiculous. It was bad enough when they put the stupid 2% inflation target out there to begin with, because at last check, the best inflation rate in the world is 0%, as opposed to losing your money in 50 years' time. So no, the Fed has wandered off the damn reservation. It is operating so far outside of its mandate. It's criminal.
But nobody will care, because as long as you have asset prices going on, that's what we've become, right? That's what the world has become. It's become a place where central bankers are basically all debasing their currencies through this process by doing this quantitative easing program. I'm mentioning the word, we're not talking about it, but negative interest rates, which is I'm not talking about it. But do they acknowledge, do you think, any of these bubbles that are forming? I mean, look what's going on with silver, the incredible run-up of silver again, and then the drop, and then, you know, asset prices with the combination of all the things that are going on with, the incredible, listen, economics and markets don't always have to work in tandem, but there has to be some kind of string that ties them together to a degree, right? Doesn't it?
Yes, that's true, but to what degree? And, I'm just going to go back to how far from their mandate they have wandered, and how much I think they absolutely need to be reined in. I mean, right now, you've got an entire generation, as I was saying before, of young investors, and they're like, what, did somebody say silver? Silver? Did David Portnoy say silver? And they go hauling into these asset classes.
Yeah.
Blind. I mean, you know, there was one story like a month ago where they had like the ticker symbol of one letter off.
And yeah, that was Tesla and Telsa, TLSA and TSLA.
Thank you very much. So that's, you're showing that is the level of naivete of these young investors. And the only thing that I would say, because everybody always says that, you know, I listened to you for 30 minutes, Danielle, and I think the damn world is going to end. The silver lining, to me at least, is you're going to have an entire generation of investors who know, really, really know in their bones, the risk of being involved in the stock market and being involved in herding into certain trades, because these kids are going to get burned to a crisp. And the only silver lining here is that they're so young. So you could actually have a much more rational generation of investors after they get burned to a crisp and have to move back in with their parents. But you could actually have a more rational generation of investors coming up behind the people who've simply quietly not, you know, don't fight the Fed. These kids are like, you know, Dave Portnoy says, don't ever, ever, ever fight the Fed, because as far as the Fed's concerned, you can only make money.
Stocks only go up. Only go up.
Only go up. And they're like, it's, you know, at least the don't fight the Fed institutional investors of today, that, you know, they pretend to do fundamental analysis, but they don't believe it.
Well, what's really interesting is all those people that say don't fight the Fed, as soon as the Fed turns and they start raising interest rates, they discuss all the reasons why it's good for markets that the interest rates are going up. It means a healthier economy. They give you this whole slew of reasons. And they say, you know, so they're staying anyway. So it's like anything else. You know, you use whatever excuse you can to make your case. And obviously, I agree with don't fight the Fed, because the, you know, flush of liquidity in the system. But when you talk about them being so far off the reservation, I mean, the biggest thing they did, in my opinion, recently that really was shocking was not only, you know, looking at the discussion about buying certain bonds in the junk bond area below investment grade, but then going out and actually saying on top of that, that they were going to buy individual bonds, certain bonds. And they ended up buying like Apple and Microsoft and things like that, which is totally bizarre.
Yeah, like, because they need extra liquidity. I mean, yeah. Please.
Right. And then on top of that, you know, what happened was that we still have in the small cap universe of stocks, 70% of the small cap Russell is unprofitable. But meanwhile, they're outperforming, the stocks are outperforming the profitable companies in the small cap, and their bonds have been held up. And I totally get, and I want to say that I agree with, we don't want anybody to fail. On the other hand, a healthy environment, it is in a capitalistic, in a quote-unquote capitalistic, not socialized capitalism like we have now, but in a capitalized environment, you want, you know, it's, the failures are part of the process, right? It's thinning the herd so the strong could survive. I mean, it's pure, survival of the fittest.
You know, it's bigger than the survival of the fittest. It's also making room for new entrants to come in and create jobs.
Right.
And, to me, the gravest sin is that before we had COVID, you know, come onto our shores, come crashing onto the United States shores, we had 14% of all the companies in America that are zombies. Now we have 20% of all companies in America that don't have adequate profit to cover their interest expense. And all they represent is a long-term drag on future productivity and the ability for the United States to be competitive as a nation. And again, this is a direct outgrowth of Fed policy. And you say to yourself, to what end? Because if you think about some of these companies that are filing for Chapter 11, you know, they've been given one lifeline after another because the capital markets, the high yield markets have been open, even though investors are like, well, this company's going out of business, but look at that coupon. So they get into it and they know the Fed's going to cover their back. But when you pile so much debt onto these zombie corporations, unfortunately, when they finally do die, they go straight to liquidation. And that's one of the things I don't think people are speaking about often enough in the current cycle. It's that when the owner of Steinmark Corporation, which had 300 some odd stores with the latest bankruptcy, retail bankruptcy filing, when they file, they're not talking about restructuring. In the fine print, it says, and closing all of its stores. That's a liquidation tied to untenable debt levels that long ago should have gone into restructuring and wiped out the shareholders and wiped out the subordinated bondholders and maintained the footprint of the company and the employee base. But that's what Fed policy does, is it makes it to where there's even less economic value to be harvested, even in the restructuring process.
You know, what I see this like is the whole idea of not letting anybody fail is the generation that it seems that I'm guilty of with my children also, which I was totally against. When my kids played ball and did sports and everybody got trophies, I'm like, no, that guy, he didn't play. He wasn't here. He's not getting, why are the only, you get a trophy. And what happens with that, here's my twisted thinking on this, and tell me what you think. My thinking is that if you have a participation trophy just by staying and playing, and you got Johnny playing softball, he's terrible. Johnny's terrible, okay? He hates playing, but he's just going to play because his parents bring him there. The problem is Johnny could have been a great tennis player, but he never got the chance to do so because he was stuck on the ball field, you know, batting eighth or ninth. And, just to get that participation trophy doesn't bring the cream of the crop up. It's kind of a weird comparison, but similar, right?
No, it's a perfect comparison. In fact, I will give my husband a rare shout out. He refused to give those damn participation rewards. Absolutely refused. And that's good. So you need to move on from flag football and not go into tackle football and get 10 concussions because you suck. move on to the sport that you belong in. And in right. that same sense, right. if you're an inefficient operator in a given sector, and you're dragging down, you're occupying capacity that could be filled by an efficient operator and generate more aggregate economic growth, and you move on to where you're better suited, then it's a win-win for the entire economy.
Right, exactly. Now, you write, you do a beautiful, by the way, beautiful job of writing, bringing not only the facts, but some wonderful storytelling from a historic basis. So great stuff. Your recent writing was, one of your recent writings was entitled The Spartans of Central Banking. And you wrote, today, modern society operates under the auspices of unquestioned central bank omnipotence. That's kind of says it all right there, doesn't it?
It does. And that's where we are.
But
that's the world that we live in right now, where there is, and that's why, and by the way, that's why socialism is so important in this context. Because you can only have implicitly trust in the omnipotence of central bankers, making sure that the rich stay rich if you keep the masses down. And there's only one way to keep the masses down at this point, because we're going to have a very long-term sclerotic unemployment situation in this country, and that's to pay them to live on to sustain them. So that's where we've come in this country. The people in the middle, they're totally screwed.
Toast. I agree with that. So, and you know, speaking about the people in the middle, and speaking about the fact that, you know, how does interest rates reductions and ZERP policy help them? But I was thinking about something. There was some study recently done that about 70% of the people that are getting the $600 per week federal unemployment were making more than they made before when they were working. You saw that, right?
I did.
Yeah. So now, how is it good for the economy if people are going back to work making less money?
Well,
have you ever thought of that?
Now you're talking about what's gone wrong with several generations of Fed policy. Remember, Greenspan in his irrational exuberance moment and the fact that he didn't want to raise margin requirements that ended up inflating the NASDAQ bubble that then imploded required that he blow another bubble in residential real estate. So in the end, 40% of U.S. workers were directly or indirectly employed care of residential real estate. And when that blew up, you created an entire generation of non-productive, irrelevant workers. And they became what was known as, in the last decade, the skill shortage in the job market, to where you could only get a job that, you know, even if you had a four-year degree, you're still working as a barista at Starbucks, to use the total cliche. But now that you've introduced this huge sector of the U.S. workforce that most of the world does not appreciate, they're like, oh, that's the wealthiest country in the world. There's a huge chunk of Americans that have been making very little money for a very long time. You give them a taste for what lower middle class as opposed to, what middle class life is like as opposed to lower middle class, they're never going back.
Is there even a middle class anymore? I mean, well, it's very hard to really pin this whole class thing like we used to have. It seems that everybody's got.
Yes, there is a middle class. It's the 68 million Americans who work at small businesses. It's the small business owner that is being driven into the ground by policy that does not. There is your crime. To answer your question, yes. There's a middle class in this country. There are still plenty of small business owners and entrepreneurs who get up every day and work really hard and run their own businesses, and they're fantastic, and they're the backbone of the U.S. economy. And they are the epitomization of the American dream. But Fed policy only helps great big insolvent companies stay alive. And fiscal policy only helps unskilled workers, put food on the table and not want to be in the workforce. Nothing. I mean, you can say the Paycheck Protection Program did something, but it left most mom and pops out to dry. So that's the idiocy of this whole thing, is that we have tried to snuff out and kill. That's my latest week's. This was yesterday's weekly was about small businesses in America, and this COVID crisis could, you know, this could be the proverbial last nail in the coffin of what's left of the middle class, because it's going to take a generation to try and build small businesses back up to where they are, because there was no liquidity to bridge solvent companies.
And then, by the way, let me interrupt here and say something. As that's all happening, and let's say there is solvency and liquidity for smaller companies, at the same time, the bigger companies are getting bigger, thereby, you know, what it is like the restaurant business. You used to have all these mom and pop and small time restaurants that serve some fantastic food around, right? And some parts of the country still have that. But other parts of the country right now, you can't make it unless you're a Cheesecake Factory, which can't make it either, by the way, but, you know, a Cheesecake Factory or an Olive Garden, or, you know, you have to be a big multi, have multiple sites and multiple, you know, this big, big company that is doing things. You know, you can't be just a hamburger shop anymore. You got to be a Shake Shack. And the Shake Shack is taking over the other guys. So this whole inequity with money going into the big companies is really hurting the small companies, thereby, in my opinion, not allowing for the small companies. I mean, could you imagine? First of all, I never understood this. Tell me if you can explain this. You know, you go to the mall and you have all those kiosks. You know, the kiosks that kind of, they made room in the center of the malls for all these little guys that are selling, you know, perfume and, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, where tweenagers can go get their ears pierced. Yes.
Right. Do people look at that and say, "Oh, I love that spot. I'm going to make a lot of money from"? I mean, how does that work, by the way? Yeah, but that's a side note. I never really understood it. But those kind of companies, you can't make it. It's not like you're going to franchise that out.
No, it's not. And you were always going. Your business model was always going to be predicated on traffic driven by the biggest by the biggest anchors. And right. By the way, you know, speaking of Cheesecake Factories, Olive Gardens may be a bit different. God help our waistline and collective national cholesterol level. So many restaurants driven by private equity. Private equity, you know, that they find a concept that's a hot concept, and they come in and, you know, Joe Q, entrepreneur, restaurant who's come up with this awesome new concept. He's like, "I've got two or three great locations picked out. I just need a little bit of capital so that I can expand." Mm-hmm. And the private equity guy says, "We'll give you the money, but only if you do 10 locations. And that is what's happened in many ways, that you've seen this massive restaurant footprint that is so huge. We're the most per capita over restaurant country in the nation. That's part of what's happened and been the death of so many smaller restaurants, is that private equity's had so much money to burn, and because the Fed's kept interest rates at artificially low levels for so long that people throw money at private equity because they're told they'll get a pickup in yield. Well, they've got to deploy those assets, and in the process, you kill yet another aspect of small businesses, which is why, you know, their small businesses employ fewer people in late 2019 than they did a decade ago.
Yeah. Crazy
stuff. We can blame it all on the Fed. We can spend 8 hours.
Yeah. Screw the Fed. No, but I mean, the Fed, listen, they play a part, but it's become the leading role, unfortunately, as I see it, rather than, you know, the stage manager in the back kind of just making sure things work the way they're supposed to work. I think that's the big problem. And, you know, they get lucrative book deals after too, and accolades and the constant discussion of them. Listen, every time the Fed talks, you could the algos are pinned in, laser focused on whatever comments they make. Markets go wild. Usually there seems to be, no matter what they say, the markets go up when the Fed talks or provides something. And let's also be clear that they're supposed to be like the nation's economist, right? And, you know, what they become is, I think, cheerleaders, and not as bad as Larry Kudlow, but, you know, cheerleaders. And they've also have a really poor record of economic forecasting. That's an agreement.
Look, let's be fair. There's a lot of individuals on the sell side, the buy side, and at the Fed that have really poor track records of trying to predict what the economy is going to do. And it's harder and harder to predict what the economy is going to do every year that more debt is placed on balance sheets, whether it's residential, you know, households, or in this current generation corporations, because the littlest thing can throw it off.
Yeah, that's why they call it the dismal science.
Economics. Yeah, well, true.
Yep. So we're going to put all the information on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 675, the show notes, how to get in touch with you, how to check out your writing and take a look at what you've done, what you have, and all that. And I really encourage people to take some time and read a few of these. You'll get hooked pretty well. So Danielle DiMartino Booth, as always, great having you. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Likewise, I enjoyed it, and you be safe and take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Take care.
You see, I told you. She's great. Isn't she great? Got to check out our book, Fed Up. It's available, of course, on Amazon. We'll have links over on the show notes for episode 675 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And that's going to wrap it up for this week, but I want to let you know that we'll be here again, of course, Monday with the Q&A pop-up, which you're all welcome to come to. And I want to tell you one thing about that, that one of the things is the ground rule for that session is that it's very simple. No question is too small. No question is insignificant. No question is going to be like laughed at. Any question you have on finance, this is where you get the opportunity to ask it. Where else would you get that opportunity? And the charge? Zip. So get over there and sign up and register for that. I will see you again next week with our great guest, as I mentioned, from TradingView, Pierce Crosby. And until then, I want to wish you a happy and healthy. Make sure to check out the Twitter stream because we're going to have, that's Andrew Horowitz, one word, by the way. We're going to have some pictures of the brisket coming on this weekend. So make sure to tell your friends to follow along, rate us on iTunes, and you have a profitable week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.